You can find inspiring stories almost anywhere. For instance, check out the co-founders of Girls Who Do Interiors. This Miami-based design company was started by three friends when they were still in school. And right from the start, they turned to Chase for Business for everything from banking and payment acceptance to credit cards. And they handled them all in one place with the Chase mobile app. It's so important to have that kind of help when you're just starting out. Learn more at chaseforbusiness.com. Make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A. member FDIC.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Pushkin.
Hey, Eddie here. Before we get started, I wanted you to know that you can listen to Car Show ad-free by becoming a Pushkin Plus subscriber. You'll also get access to Detours, bonus episodes of Car Show where we go for extended drives, play outtakes, and more. Find Pushkin Plus on the Car Show page in Apple Podcasts or at pushkin.fm.
In some ways, the most important cars in the world are our first cars. These were the cars that gave us our first real taste of freedom, not to mention our first taste of the late-night Taco Bell drive-thru. First cars are important enough to us here at Car Show that we're going to mix it up this week and do a couple of interviews with two of our favorite polymaths, Lake Bell and Rob Corddry. Lake and Rob are actors, writers, directors, and voice artists. To these multi-hyphenates, we add car people. They're going to tell us about their first cars and how formative they were to their lives and careers. I'm Eddie Alterman. On this special Hollywood episode of Car Show, we delve into the automotive lives of these two committed gearheads. First up is Lake Bell. You might know her as Agnes Adler in the movie It's Complicated, or as the voice of Katrina Peanut Butter in BoJack Horseman. She also wrote and directed the film In a World. Lake's car enthusiasm runs in the family. She grew up in Florida and New York, and her dad, Harvey Siegel, is a collector of Shelby Cobras and Special Fords, like the GT40 and the Shelby Mustang KR. In our conversation, Lake talks about everything from the car that sparked her obsession with Italian metal to finally mastering the manual transmission. But first, we play my favorite parlor game. Guess that first car.
Do you mean the first car that I purchased with my own money or the car that I was generously given from my father?
The car that you were given from your father. Okay, so that tells me something.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a couple of questions. Did you start driving in New York City or in Florida?
Florida.
Okay. Was it domestic or import?
Import.
And it was your dad's car?
No. Lease.
A lease? Okay. Give me three guesses. BMW 3 Series convertible?
No, sir. To this day, I'm not a convertible person. But you're kind of going in the wrong direction, to be honest.
Really?
You're giving Harvey too much credit.
So, Honda Civic?
No.
Warmer?
Warmer in the sense that it's less exotic and less sort of rich kitty, but still, okay. But little, a sprinkle of, I mean, there was a great privilege in the car that I have.
It's getting tough.
Well, let me say this.
It's, okay.
I mean, if you're a father and you don't want your daughter getting in a bender, you know, a fender bender or whatnot after a bender, what would you want her to drive? Would you want her to be in a two-door? No. Would you want her to be even in a sedan? Probably not. If you're really neurotic and you're Jewish and you're from New York, you're going to want an SUV.
You want to put some metal around.
Yeah, you want her a little higher up.
So was it a Nissan Pathfinder?
Closer. See, now you're in the pocket. Now you're in the zone. We almost got that one.
Toyota 4Runner?
Okay, there he is. Got it.
Yes, I got it. Okay. 4Runner, that's a great choice.
He got me the 4Runner and it was terrific. But I will say there was one kicker about it, which is just ironic, really, given that it is the 4Runner. He got the two-wheel drive.
Well, you were in Florida. You didn't need it.
Yeah, but then I ended up going to Skidmore for a year. And let me tell you something, upstate New York, I bought a lot of kitty litter for the back, for the trunk, let me tell you. Didn't have a cat.
But you put snow tires on it, right?
You know what? There was like a lot of talk of putting chains on the tires, which, you know, the 18-year-old version of myself, I was like, I don't even know where to begin with that. Like, I don't know, like, who am I going to go to? I don't want to do it. It seems like a big, you know, because then you would drive into the city and all of a sudden you got chains on your tire. And what, I'm supposed to take them off? Yeah, you just take them off. I'm like, I'm not taking, no. So it was more just like bricks and kitty litter in the back.
Smart.
I was 18. Listen, I ended up leaving and going to England. So I left at 19 to go to England. And that's where I have my first car that I actually purchased because I saved up some money. I had $2,000. So that's going to help you figure out and guess what I consider my real first car.
Okay. So was this a car that you could only get in Europe?
I mean, no, but the thematic of the UK is heavily at large here.
Okay, so a Mini?
Yes, sir. 1987. D-Reg.
Oh, wow. That's
and
great.
At the time, I didn't even drive stick. So I had this like real kind of block against driving stick because driving in my family was such a thing. Yeah. And like, if you're not going to drive, you know, how dare you not drive stick? And, you know, there was just such an onus on it that I was rebelling by saying, I'm going to buy an automatic. And if you think of like a 1987 Austin Mini, that's automatic. I mean, that's like a go-kart.
Yeah,
that's basically true. A golf cart.
Right. And you were in London. It's super parkable. That's a big kind of spectrum to go from.
I know. But it, I mean, in the UK, a Mini is like an SUV. I mean, you can fit 10 people in there.
I know. They're huge inside.
Kind of. Yeah. I mean, I was 19 and then 20, 21. I spent 4 years in London and that red Mini was like integral to my existence and my lifeline to my social life. I mean, I was the only one with the car. So, you know, everyone's like, I'm going to take that car. We'll get in.
So you were like the designated driver.
Always.
That's sort of unfair.
Yeah, but it's cool to have wheels. So, you know, you give and you take.
Yeah. Did you get the knowledge of like how to get around London? Because, you know, cabbies talk about that.
Oh, yeah. We had, I had my A to Z map. You would just have to look up where you're going. So you go in the back and you're like, okay, I'm going to Shropshire, you know, like Boulevard, you know, whatever. And then you go SE12 or whatever. And then you have to look it up and figure it the fuck out.
And then you came back to the US. Was the 4Runner still there?
No. We sold the 4Runner and then I moved to LA and then I had to again. I had to borrow money for this one because in LA, again, I was like, oh, I can just, you know, sell the Mini for like $7 and then, you know, get a car in LA. But of course, my dad was like, you drive in LA, you can't have a small car. You know, he's like, you need a proper SUV. You know, like he had a real thing about like kids and SUV.
I want to talk about your family. I love that imitation of your dad. So he's a Brooklyn guy.
You know what? He is a New York, your quintessential New York gentleman Jew. So he has, my brother and my sisters and I all kind of amp up his plosives and whatnot when we do an impression of him. Because if we didn't, it just wouldn't be as fun. But, you know, you know, the Kia, you know, Ford GT40, you don't want to, it's low to the ground. That's how he speaks. And then my mom has like a really sort of like the opposite of whatever that is. So she has a very sort of soft-spoken, you know, sort of more quintessentially kind of waspy sound. So they have a real vocal cocktail. And speaking of sounds, I mean, often when I think about cars, I grew up with on race car tracks my whole life because of my father, Harvey Siegel, who owned and restored Virginia International Raceway, as well as
the best track in the U.S.
Best track in the U.S., as you know. I mean, yeah, you should. You should. but I'd been going to like Lime Rock and, you know, the Poconos and, you know, just, I mean, but really VIR. And then New Jersey Motorsport Park was also his. And so, you know, he had been an amateur racer and a very serious collector for my whole life. So this relationship I had with cars really stemmed from, you know, the car world was the way in to connect with him in many ways. It's just that's like his other children, you know? And so there were times where it's like, oh, I didn't really know how to access and have a deep conversation with him, but he would take me to the Javits Center, to the auto show, and we would walk around. And those are really important moments, you know, because those are like kind of my main connection point. And he enjoys telling, you know, his children the kind of history of certain cars, the great kind of melodramatic stories of racers and why, you know, why Porsche is cool or why it isn't, you know, yeah. And why he prefers Fords in general. The smells and the experiential kind of connection that I have to automotives in general is just, you know, it comes from this place. And then now I've taken on its own life within my own sort of experience.
I had the same sort of experience with my father. I got all these Talmudic lessons through the car business. You know, he was so into cars and I inherited that from him, but that's how he like taught me about the world.
Absolutely. I mean, cars are touch points for indelible moments in our life. There's a nostalgia and a sort of visceral kind of the smells and the sounds and the way the leather felt or the way the fabric felt or whatever it is about a car that really reminds you, oh, God, that's when I went to Skidmore, or, oh, God, that's when I lived right on Creek Road. Remember? In, you know, and so there's utility involved, obviously. There is efficiency involved, but then there's also just like, God, that's your conduit to getting anywhere. You know, yeah. It's a privilege. Like, not everyone gets to have a car. It still ends up being this thing that's special, you know, whether you're a single mom of five kids, you know, and you need that goddamn car, or if you're just like, I have dreamed of this 246 my entire life, you know, and finally made enough money to get it.
There's this kind of magic of self-guided locomotion, right? Self-directed locomotion. There's nothing but when you're like driving and in control, it's incredible. It's an incredible feeling of power.
There is a sense of sacred privacy, the sanctity of that cocoon that you've earned that can take you places. I mean, good Lord, it's magic. You know, that's why I say it's a privilege, because we often forget and we take it for granted. But I mean, that's why there's so many times when you're driving and you're in the car and you're listening to a song and a song comes on and you're like, I could drive to Oregon, you know? And there's something about, you know, like, you're not going to do it, but you could.
Yeah, exactly.
The promise of the maybe.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you, who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakeables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, NA member, FDIC, copyright 2024. JPMorgan Chase & Co.
How do cars inform character? Like, one of the coolest, I thought, car character matchups was in It's Complicated and Alec Baldwin's character driving that blue 911 Cabrio. I'm like, of course.
Well, I know. And you know what? It's like, for instance, there was in a world I had to have like a certain kind of 90s Corvette, and it had to be maroon. It had to be maroon, like metallic maroon, for my dad in it, played by Fred Melamed,
who is like the king, right?
The best.
Huge, yeah. Melamed fan.
And I have a whole scene in there where, you know, the father, who's just not considering his daughter at all, says, you know, I'll take you there. And of course, there's no back seat in that model.
Right.
So she's like, there's story in that of like, yeah, like if we get into an accident, like you're cooked. Like there's no seat for you at this table. Okay.
All about him and that sort of like maroon car. It's like, no, it's not red.
No.
Maroon.
Oh, it's got a metallic.
Who would have a red Corvette? Like, you can't have a red Corvette. That's totally cliched. I have a maroon Corvette.
Yeah.
That 90s color.
Burgundy, maroony. That maroon. Love it. So anyway, those are the kind of things where I really enjoy when I'm making a film or you know, creating a character. I do think about it a lot. I think it says, in the same way that the wardrobe says a lot, you know, you can paint a picture of what someone's morning routine might be like and what they're doing off camera if you can know what they are donning or what they are driving.
What are some of your favorite movie cars?
Well, I mean, look, Scorsese, Goodfellas for me was a really good car film. I mean, there's just something about those massive Bodhi 60s, 70s caddies, the Eldorados and the Biarritzes and the, you know, there's such balls to that, like to take up that much space for two doors, you know,
like, yeah, like tiny inside, huge on the outside.
Yeah, like I'm taking up some space, you know what I mean? Like it's just a little, but it's perfection.
And so grandiose, right? Like remember in that scene where she's like, oh, I thought that, you know, the wives would be so fancy, but they were all like wearing those rayon blends. That's what those cars were. They were not like European GTs.
Yeah. And which I really, and yet I understand and see the appeal in it. I mean, I have looked into purchasing one, but, you know, I wouldn't kick one of those out of bed. But I, you know, because also there is something so unbelievably sort of whimsical and wacky about the color schemes they had in that day. It's like, all white on white and then bright cherry red interior. And it's like, that was just, yeah, that's factory. You know, like.
This, I know, that's like, some wild shit.
I love it. I love it. It's got such personality. And now it's like, what kind of gray do you want?
So when you were growing up, did your dad teach you how to drive on the track?
So I was terrified of speed. I'm still not a massive speed demon. I'm more interested in the kind of Tetris driving, I call it, which is like city driving where it's like, oh, this person's going over there. Okay, I'll go over there. You know, it's like, oh, I see you. Okay, you're up my ass. All right, watch this. You know, it's like, I think I probably would be more interested in like rally driving, you know. But that said, my father did teach me to drive on a KR 500, so a King of the Road 500.
Oh my God.
He's a big Shelby Cobra guy. Yeah. And, you know, my relationship was good with him, but I mean, that's a lot. Because remember, I had the whole like hang up about manual when I was a kid. And so I was just like, oh shit. Like, you know, I'm just going to fucking fuck this car up. You know?
Was it a test, you think? Like he was saying, like.
Honestly, cars is where he shines, right? So like he really was like, all right, kid, you know, like get in there and let's see what we can do. And we were out in New Jersey at our country house, and that's where his like mechanics live and where we have a big garage of toys. And we were on like a gravel road and we were in the KR and he's like, go ahead, give it a go. And I was
that's
like,
mayhem.
It's
that's
mayhem.
Crazy.
Throwing it in first and then boom, bing, boom, bing, you know, just like back, forth, back, just like such tentative clutch touching, like not, oh, got stalling, you know. But then, of course, it's like once you get it into first, it's like the torque on that thing is like insane. You could throw it in third and you're fine, you know.
Yeah, started like, in third. Like, so explain what the KR is.
You're like in a Mustang, like beast, basically. And it's like, I mean, it's called King of the Road. So I think, you know, when you're coming out with balls of steel like that, I think you understand exactly what we're dealing with. You know, it was complicated sometimes where, you know, it felt like there was such an onus, as I said, on manual shift and all that stuff. And I would talk to my brother about it who did race. And I'd be like, I just feel like, I don't know. I can't. He's like, you can do it. Like kids in fucking rural whatever driving stick, you know, they're like 14-year-olds driving stick trucks everywhere, you know, to tend to farms. Like, why are you making this so neurotic? And so eventually when I was a big kid and grown up, I found a Mini, a secondhand Mini that had all this like, it was a Cooper that had a bunch of aftermarket shit on it and it was lowered. And I was like, but it's a Mini. Like, why is it lowered? They're like, I don't know. Some guy from Devo owned it. I was like, really?
Really?
Yeah, it was really cool.
Oh, that's amazing.
I know. So immediately I was like, well, yeah, I need to buy this. So I went to this dealer in La Cañada. Like, it was really far from my house. And I took a cab there and I fucking got there, signed all the paperwork, and the guy gave me the keys. And I said, listen, I don't fully know how to drive manual. I've only done it once on a KR. And he's like, not at all. And I was like, well, could you just give me like a parking lot tutorial, you know? And he was like, yeah, okay. So then we're just in the parking lot with this random guy. And we just, you know, I he gave me some hot tips, and because it wasn't like the onus of my cool driving dad, I just was like, I felt more comfortable in a way, you know, to just do it. And I drove it off and I drove on, got right on the highway and went home. And I just thought, oh my God, I literally was talking to myself. I was like, okay, is that the RPM now? You know? And so that became my Mini for many, many years, you know? And so because I had this connection to the Mini because it was my first car and because it was like, God, my formative years in England, like, you know, those are the years, like 19, 20, 21, 22, you know, like that's big deal. So to have it again at like 26 or whatever, you know, one that I earned because I was like on TV shows and I could buy a car now and yeah. It's going to be a stick, damn it. You know, it's like, it was a real kind of moment for me.
See, I made it.
I got my fucking lowered Mini that hits on like every parking lot I went into. It'd be like, scratch, you know?
But it's also like the antithesis of like a Harvey car. It's not a big
exactly.
Block Ford.
Exactly. It was like I had to define my own automotive journey.
So what was sort of like your spark car? You know how birders talk about having a spark bird, like the first bird that they like fell in love with and got them into it. Is there one for you?
Yeah. I mean, I got a lot of spark cars. You know, when I first saw a Lamborghini Miura, I was like, I'm sorry, what? I just was like, am I dating that car? Like, did he, is that car throwing me rhythm right now? Like, you know, I just was like, what is happening to me?
It seduced you.
It seduced me. And there was something about the Italian cars of that era, the 70s kind of shark cars, I call them, where they're just, they just, you know, they're dangerous, but you love them and you're intrigued by them. And they probably break down a lot. I don't know. But, you know, it's like the Detomazzo and the, you know, the kind of these beautiful, very sexy Italian, you know, I love Italian culture. So for me, I think that really sold it even harder to me. I was like, so then I started learning Italian just so that, you know, one day. But I also love the Cinquecento, the original. I saw them on the track and they were so damn cute and all with such great personality and senses of humor. I was like, I can get into this. So just to go back to it, it was like, there's a sense of humor to the Mini. So I think that's what I was gravitating to. I wasn't like, oh, I want to be, you know, sexy, you know, badass girl yet. I just wasn't there. I was like, I'm still a kid in some ways. And I just think this is cute. And then the Miura was just like, wow, I'm going to be an adult one day. That's what I said.
Those are really interesting polls, right? You know, like of
I know.
Italian car culture.
And then, of course, it was like the Pantera. You know, the shapes were appealing, you know.
And so impractical. And there's, you know, yeah. In Kill Bill.
Oh, yeah.
Bill drives a Mangusta. He drives a...
Yeah, the Mangusta is amazing.
Just the wheels, the way they, like, they're punched into the body and they're just like, oh, just oozing. Just
I mean,
animal.
I would kill to have a Mangusta.
Pheromones.
Yeah. You're just like, this is all kinds of wrong and give me the keys. You know?
Like the worst car to drive. So unreliable, but so who unreliable. Cares? Okay. Lightning round. Three dream cars.
Well, you got me onto the Mangusta. So let's do a little Mangusta. Let's get a 246 in there. And then I'd like a Pontiac Trans Am.
You would? With the screaming chicken?
Yeah, absolutely. I listen, I like a car with a sense of humor and with a whole, like I could build a whole character around it, you know?
Smokey and the Bandit.
Yeah, Smokey and the Bandit, yeah. If anyone has a Pontiac Trans Am with the fucking bird and all, call me.
My friend Alana, who writes for Car and Driver, she's got one. It's brown.
Oh, I love brown. So sick. Yeah. I mean, listen, I got to talk to Alana. Maybe she needs to let me take care of it.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Join hosts Ben Walter, CEO of Chase for Business, and Tanya Nebo, a lawyer and business consultant, on these storytelling journeys of trials, tribulations, and triumphs that hinged on a single event, a split-second decision, or even a stroke of luck. Whether the story is about a warehouse going up in flames or a former partner stealing a whole roster of clients, each episode will showcase the grit, determination, and resourcefulness a small business owner needed to turn a pivotal situation into a springboard for success. Listen to The Unshakables now and learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase mobile app is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company.
Next up, Lake's friend and now mine, Rob Corddry. You probably know Rob from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, where his stand-up segments bristled with manic energy. Or from Hot Tub Time Machine, which is maybe the best movie title this side of Snakes on a Plane. He's brought his ink-black comedy to shows like Ballers with The Rock, and now the latest American iteration of Top Gear with Dax Shepard and Jethro Bovingdon. Their new season launches July 1st. We spoke with Rob about his first car and those thereafter. Why does the Trans Am always keep coming up?
Thank you for being here. You're one of my favorite closet car geek, but now you've outed yourself with your Top Gear experience.
Yep, I've finally come out. I've had the courage. You know, all my friends are like, what are you talking about? You're not a car guy. And I was like, I met you in New York. Like, I lived in New York for 12 years, and I kind of dropped the whole car thing because there's no need for it. And I don't know, I just kind of lost the fire. But then when I moved to LA, it's you know, fast to rekindle.
Oh, yeah. It's a car show every day in LA. But
yeah.
I admire your bravery.
My dentist invited me to his Cars and Coffee.
Everybody's got a car show. That's awesome. So I want to take you back to the beginning.
Okay.
And, I Googled this, so it was no, process of, divination. I just figured I should do a little research and figure out what your first car was.
It was a 1975 Ford Pinto wagon, white with the woody walls. A right piece of shit.
and now this is a car that had a reputation for exploding if a bird so much as shat on it, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what I was fond of saying? Because I loved that car when I had it, right? Like, it was my first car. I got it for $5,
$5?
$5 from this old man who just used to drive it to the dump. And he just, you know how, like, you need a bill of sale?
Yeah.
Well, he actually collected the $5 that usually you just write down, but he was really by the book. So he was like, and $5, please. So I actually bought it for $5. And it wasn't the wagons, apparently, that were famous for exploding. Right. And, I did a piece on this. It hasn't aired yet. It's going to be in our third season, about the Ford Pinto and its tendency to explode. And it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek piece, but it was greatly exaggerated, to say the least.
Yes.
American cars were losing at that point. You know, all the great muscle cars were sort of fading away. And
they were all being smogged out of existence. Like, all the power is being choked down. And you had, like, the Trans Ams were making 110 horsepower and had,
I drove one of those, man. For Top Gear, like 1978, like the Smokey and the Bandit car.
Screaming
what,
chicken.
What a piece of shit. I mean, it was a gorgeous museum quality car. The guy had done beautiful work on it, but he was like, yeah, try not to take it above 55 because it'll overheat. It just spent the whole day overheating.
Yeah, I mean, the best one of those in the world is still an unmitigated piece of crap.
Yeah, it's too bad. It's too bad.
But I want to talk more about that Pinto because, like, do you have any memorable adventures?
Oh, yeah.
In that?
Yeah, so I loved that car more than anything. I would go into, whatever the East Coast equivalent of an O'Reilly's is and try and, like, what am I going to do to this car? And there's nothing. I don't know what I'm doing in a car. I had no idea. I'd end up getting an air freshener or something. And I had a girlfriend at the time. I was very much in love. She was like 2 years older than me. She was in college, and I used to take her out in my car, and it was a wagon. And it came, the guy was older than the dirt, man. This guy could barely walk. And he was like, and if you notice here in the bed, we've got, left a pillow and a blanket there for you in case you want to take a nap while you're driving. So yeah, I used to park with my girlfriend in the cemetery.
A built-in boudoir.
Only guy that had a pillow in the back of his car, that's for sure. An old man's pillow. And it used to...
But that relationship didn't last?
No, she cheated on me. She probably cheated on me with somebody else's car, really. It was probably that car that killed it because the floorboard on the passenger seat was completely rusted out. So every time we went over a puddle, which in Boston was significant, like they were everywhere, she would get soaked. she would learn to like just put her feet up on the dashboard when we went over a puddle. And I would like to drive by my old house growing up right now and see if they've paved over the holes that car left in the driveway, because apparently oil is a corrosive. Oh. I had no idea. There were, you know, 2-inch deep holes in that. And I had that car for maybe 2 years. Burned a hole right in there.
Amazing.
Yeah.
It left its mark. Do you have like sort of memorable associations with moments in your life and certain cars?
Those cars were long before I even realized that acting was a job that people could do. You know, growing up in Weymouth, Massachusetts, it's like 10 minutes, 15 minutes south of Boston. There wasn't a job that people did. Nobody ever left Weymouth, and let alone became, became movie actors or TV actors. So it took a long time for me to realize that was an actual goal. So I would say it would have to be, if I had any car connection to my career, it would be that my wife and I, when we were living in New York, I was on The Daily Show, and I inherited, her father had died, and we inherited a, what was it, 94 Corolla 5-speed, another piece of crap and a long line of crappy cars I've had. But that car, man, I lived in Brooklyn. The Daily Show was on like 55th and by the water, like all the way, as far as you can get away from Brooklyn. And I used to race myself every single day. And if I caught the lights right, I could make it home. I think I made it home once in 12 minutes. And my friend Jim said, hey, can I get a ride home with you? He was just like, live right down the block. And I was like, you can, but I want to warn you, you're not going to enjoy the ride. It's going to be terrible. I drive like an a-hole. And he was like, come on. I'm an adult. And he's just gripping every handle in the car. I didn't hit a brake once. It's like when you're driving in New York, there's taxi driver rules. You don't look behind you. No. You just turn, switch lanes.
It's one of the best driving environments in the world.
It really is. If you know how to do it, if you're confident in the taxi driver rules.
You cannot hesitate.
You can't hesitate. Yeah. When I constantly cut into long lines to get off here in LA, because everybody, they're not great drivers in that they're very careful drivers. They're very courteous to a fault. And so they'll be waiting in a long line to get off the highway. And I just scream right down to the very end of that line and just cut someone off. And I call it Brooklyning it.
I love that. I mean, do you think legalized marijuana has anything to do with it?
It's like not helping.
The mellowness in LA.
Yeah, it definitely doesn't help.
No, you know? I mean, I think the richest experience in New York is behind the wheel of the car, because you're so stressed out and you're just, it's moment to moment. And yeah. I think cars are about context in some way. Like, sure. You know, that piece of shit Corolla is like maybe the best car for New York City.
It's right? You don't care about it for sure.
No. And you're going to be rubbing and dinging it up. And
oh yeah.
You don't care what happens to it. So, I mean, do you remember all those no radio,
signs. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. You know,
the car was just sort of like a delivery system for the radio. And
yeah,
people would smash windows and just grab those. Like,
yeah, I had an ashtray full of change, and that was my mistake. So my window got smashed, and they just took like $4 in pennies and nickels, you know, and a couple of very valuable quarters. In Manhattan, you know, the quarters are like, you know, although, have you ever heard of the Universal Life Church? It's one of those like sort of matchbook churches that you become a minister just so you can marry people.
Oh, my daughter just did that.
Yeah, sure. Okay. A lot of people. I actually married our friend Lake Bell.
You were the officiant.
I was the officiant. Yeah, I didn't marry them. So I did it originally so I could get the parking pass. I got a minister parking pass and a little thing that, you know, what do they call those things you clip on your rear view mirror? The a little thing that said pastor on it. And I had an official thing with a gold seal on my dashboard. So if I parked in Manhattan anywhere near like a block or two away from a church, I would never get a ticket.
It's like a diplomat plate or something.
Exactly. And it worked. It worked. I parked for free in Manhattan for years. Like the Daily Show was right near a church. So I just parked anywhere.
Incredible. That's incredible. Worth it. That's like what the kids call a life hack.
That it was life hack before there were life hacks. Yes.
I wanted to talk about how after you branched out into directing and started to think about kind of the bigger picture of filmmaking, I was really interested in how do you think like cars inform character? Like when you're setting something up in like the production design or whatever, how do you approach that?
It's very, very important. And it's very difficult to convince a line producer, the guy that's in charge of the schedule and the money and the budget, that, you know, you need a 1987 GNX, you know, you just need it for this character. It's, you know, right. or, you know, or whatever the car may be. Like you have to be on like a Ballers basically, because Ballers, it's like story came second to the cars, the sneakers, the watches.
You had a McLaren on that show, right?
Unfortunately, I did not have a McLaren. I had one of those BMW
i8. Right, so i8.
It's like the fake McLaren. They tried very hard to look like a McLaren, and you know that car gets a bad rap. I only got to drive it a couple times, but I got air in that car. It was fun.
That was a super cool car. I mean,
yeah, it was. I mean, it didn't last long, but I enjoyed it. You know, the very little I got to drive it. That character started off driving a Buick in the season one, because that's the car that Peyton Manning drove. And Spencer, the Rock's character, basically had to explain to him that that's just a sponsorship deal, man. Peyton drives a Corvette. He doesn't drive a Buick. And I was like, oh. So then the next day I had the i8.
Nice.
You know? And so then just, it was a long stream of pretty good cars. It's so many that I can't really even remember. The best one was the car, my final car in that show was a DBS, a big 12-cylinder Aston Martin. And oh my God, what a car. I mean, heavy, as you felt the weight of that car as you were driving, which was kind of a hindrance, but it was such a beautiful, I've been an Aston Martin fan, a reluctant Aston Martin fan ever since, just because I'll never be able to afford one.
And I mean, that's great character development right there, from the Buick to the i8 to the 12 cylinder, you know?
Yeah.
And those cars have that secret handshake, that smell, like when you get into them, you feel like you are in some English drawing room, you know?
Absolutely. It's like, every car from the 70s has a certain smell, and those Astons they smell like money, man. And I've luckily somehow finagled my way into becoming the Aston Martin guy on Top Gear.
Nice.
So whenever there's a new Aston Martin, I get to review it. I just reviewed the DBX
707.
Awesome car. I was very surprised. It's an awesome car. The Vantage, I got to, you know, which every time I want to buy a car, I build and price a Vantage online. And it's never going to happen.
It's disgusting. I mean, like, you know, somebody was saying that $100,000 is the new $40,000.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's upwards. If you really want to spec one out correctly, it's almost 200 grand. I can't justify that. Even if I had that, I'm a character actor, you know, I'm a working man for hire. can't do that.
At a very high level. But no, I understand what you're saying. It's like, I think those are just cars for traders. And for them, like 200 grand is like buying a sweater or something.
Yeah. And then they just keep it in their garage and they're, you know, they put a humidifier in there and whatever they do. I don't know what they do.
There's a cruelty to that. You know, the people who want these things the most can't get near them. But it's, you know, Top Gear, like me, you know, my whole job allows me access to these things. And I'm sure Top Gear is the same for you. How did you come to be on the show?
Right?
It's true.
Since I got to LA in 2005 or 2006, I have been basically monopolizing my press time by saying that I loved cars, because I was really started to get back into cars, and I was able, you have to buy cars when you're in LA, whereas you didn't in New York. And so I was able to sort of exercise that, you know, I was never able to lease cars before, and boy, just have a car for 3 years and then you can have another great car. It was just awesome. And so, you know, I basically just planted it in the press, and it was really just so I could get press cars, which didn't really work. And then all of a sudden, you know, 15 years later, Top Gear called. And they were like, we're going to have three hosts, of course. Dax Shepard is already on. We want you to be the second one. And I was like, I didn't even let them finish their sentence. I was like, you can go through your spiel, but the answer is yes.
It's the best gig in the world, right?
It really is. I mean, it was terrifying, you know, because I sort of on the show represent the sort of the everyman, the enthusiast.
You're the Pinto guy.
I'm the Pinto guy, right? Yeah. Jethro and Dax Shepard have a lifetime of car experience. And I just, you know, like looking at them and driving them and kissing them and licking them, you know, like I love them as a museum goer loves art. And, you know, I represent that. So on Top Gear, I have become the guy they put in very awkward, scary situations. And now they're like, okay, we're going to fill up your car with packing peanuts and you're going to have to drive around this track. And I have like basically a little tiny window and all these peanuts just sort of really susceptible to gravity. and it was just, and I hate peanuts to begin with. Those packing peanuts are like a phobia of mine, basically.
Really?
They didn't even know that at the time, but they were thrilled.
There's this thing about like that show where the cars really are a prism, you know, for the relationship between the three hosts. And, you know, what was a kind of memorable thing for you in those seasons where the car was really sort of, for lack of a better term, that kind of vehicle for the adventure, for what like a car that really said something about what you were trying to accomplish?
Well, I think it was probably my first real victory. I mean, I decided that if I was going to have any success on this show, and I mean success in terms of winning races and that sort of thing and challenges, it was going to be because I chose the best car for the job.
Yeah.
You know, and I would actually just do research, and I would spend days trying to figure out what the right car is. Whereas those guys were like, I'm just going to get a car that I want to drive.
Interesting.
And they invariably just choose the wrong car. So it was like an off-roading race to get to the top of this hill. It was made out of like lava rock, basically, this big, pretty big hill. And we were in Arizona somewhere, and it was gorgeous. And I'm sort of an outdoor guy. This is my sweet spot. And so I chose this 4Runner, one of the older 4Runners, you know, with all the chrome. I forget what year it was, but
locking axles.
It was the perfect car for this. And Dax had one of those aftermarket four-wheel drive kits in a Ford van, the Econoline van that, they were this famous aftermarket. thing. And when he presented it, I just smiled. I was like, it's going to break. It's going to break. It's breaking right now as we're talking. You should get in there and drive it. And what did Jethro chose this amazing, I think it was like a also four-wheel drive aftermarket big tires. It was like a Subaru. It was like a WRX or something. Oh. But it was totally tricked out for off-road. And he did fine. You know, he had the speed for sure, but I had all the power. And my first victory was not only getting to the top of the hill first, but then going back down three quarters of the way down the hill and towing Dax all the way up. Because he had put a waterbed in the back of his. So I also had this big knife on my side, this big Bowie knife, and I got to take it out and like slash his waterbed.
Just compound the humiliation.
Yeah, it was the best. And he was just bummed out the whole time.
It's kind of hilarious that, like, you know, the actor comedian is the most pragmatic when it comes to the car choice for the challenges.
Well, I mean, you know, I guess that's an interesting comparison, because I mean, the way I you know, approach comedy, to me, they're like, people say, oh, would you ever do a drama? And I'm like, well, yeah, sure. It's the same thing to me. I approach it this, I, you know, put together a character the same way I did for, you know, when I was doing Shakespeare years and years and years ago. I build the, I want there to be a light behind my eyes. And So, yeah, I am very pragmatic when it comes to making choices in acting and on Top Gear, you know, in cars.
Yeah, you're super intentional about it.
Yeah, I made one really bad choice. And it's kind of like, because I was just in a bad mood, I think, and I just shat out my choice. And I ended up with, I forget what the challenge was, but I ended up with a Saab 900. And that car just, I gave up at one point. I was like, nah, I'm out. Here, you guys go.
I've got a whole theory about Saabs and guys who own Saabs.
Please tell me.
Oh, they want to be car guys so badly, but they just don't know what's good.
Well, this was also like, I just didn't know what to choose for this particular challenge. I don't even remember what the challenge was. And one of the producers, Dave, was he would like suggest some cars, and I just took his first choice because he loved Saabs. He's the kind of guy that loves crappy cars. Just to like love, you know, just to be that guy.
I don't want to offend you if you own a Tesla, but I feel like.
No, come on, man. We've been talking for 42 minutes. So you think I own a Tesla?
I knew better than to assume. Jeez, sorry.
Oh my God. My wife won't even get a Tesla.
I love it.
Yeah.
But what do you have now? You have the 911 and.
I got rid of the 911 because I was ordered the Bronco. I ordered the new Bronco and I've been waiting for it for 2 years. So I finally just lost interest in it and I canceled it. You know, it still wasn't in production.
Yeah.
And, you know, cause I ordered the Wildtrak and of course the hard top moldable roof, which is impossible apparently.
Yeah.
Like you're seeing Broncos out there, but they're all soft tops. And so finally I just canceled that. And now I've got no car.
Really?
I mean, I've got cars, but you know, my 1978 280Z is not a daily driver. You know, my Sprinter is not a daily driver. And I'm waiting basically for my guy to send me a bunch of I've never had an M, a BMW M. I've never had an AMG, and I've never had a V, a Cadillac V.
Okay.
But I've driven like a bunch of CTSs and a bunch of ATSs and stuff. And so finally I decided, you know what? Now's the time. I'm going to get the new Blackwing.
Blackwing. I mean, first of all, how cool is the name? Blackwing.
A Blackwing, man.
So sinister.
Yeah.
And then it's just phenomenal. I mean, it's one of those.
I can't wait.
It's one of those like new digital cars that feels analog. It's so good. So like nuanced and like it's got titanium rods and the shifter and they just went all out on that thing.
Yeah. Yeah. That magnetic damping and all that. It's like, if he has trouble finding one that is even close to my spec, I'm going to be heartbroken.
I think you need that.
I think I need that too.
Rob, this was amazing. Thank you so much for...
Oh, so much fun, man.
It was just so good to talk to you.
It was so great. I love talking cars.
Car Show is written and hosted by me, Eddie Alterman. It's produced by Sam Dingman, Jacob Smith, and Amy Gaines. Our editor is Jen Guerra. Original music and mastering by Ben Tolliday. Our executive producer is Mia Lobel. Our show art was designed by Sean Carney and airbrushed by Greg Lefevre. Our patron saints are Lital Malad and Justine Lang. And be sure to check out Lake Bell's forthcoming audiobook with Pushkin. It's called Inside Voice, My Obsession with How We Sound, and it comes out this November. Car Show is a production of Pushkin Industries. If you love this show and others from Pushkin Industries, consider subscribing to Pushkin Plus. Pushkin Plus is a podcast subscription that offers bonus content and uninterrupted listening for just $4.99 a month. Look for Pushkin Plus on Apple Podcast subscriptions. To find more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.